محمد وآل محمد.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Ammar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The 173 days of U.S.-Israeli genocide confirmed by U.N. experts, over 32,500 murdered, over 100 deaths repeatedly occurring during 24-hour time spans. Yet one of the only achievements of the so-called international community is for the U.S. to abstain from a resolution for a temporary ceasefire instead of a veto, widening the U.S.-Israeli spat. Ceasefire talks have hit a dead end one after another, with each side blaming the other, though it is clear that the Israeli regime is the one committing the genocide. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at things like Israel's international isolation, humanitarian issues like the controversial U.S. airdrops, amongst many others, and the Yemeni army's continued targeting of Israeli-bound vessels, including ones from the U.S. and the U.K. First, let me introduce our guests. Saad Nimr, professor of political science at Birzeit University, joins us from occupied Ramallah. Also joining us is Fahima Mohammed, who's a broadcaster and TV presenter from London. Welcome to you both. Saad Nimr, let me first start with you and get your reaction on what the UN expert Albanese has said. She's a UN special rapporteur on the rights situation in the Palestinian territories, Francesca Albanese. Quote, there are reasonable grounds to believe that Israel has committed the crime of genocide against Palestinians. Israel has committed three acts of genocide with the requisite intent. Well, what's your reaction to that?
Well, that was this morning in the session of the United Nations Security Council, as well as the United Nations General Assembly in many cases, and on that it was also in Palestine. And she addressed the audience with this statement. It is about time. Now, when we are talking about organizations, most of the organizations around the world are admitting that there is a genocide in many accounts, not only three as she mentioned, but even more. But this is a view of their investigation to talk about, you know, three kinds of genocide and war crimes in Gaza. Everyone knows now, and even after the ICC also ruling about, you know, the Israelis that should commit and not to commit any kind of genocide, it is a kind of admission that there is a kind of genocide going on. And now we are waiting to see what would follow in the ICC. However, it's not now about that the whole world do know that there is a genocide and there is war crimes one after another in every day on a daily basis. It's not that the most important thing. The most important thing, what the international community or so-called international community going to do. They are doing nothing apart from, you know, these statements. We heard many statements from so many people in sure. positions, including Guterres himself. But so far, there is no action being taken in order to stop Israel from this genocide or to force Israel to stop the genocide and the war crimes committed against the Palestinians.
Well, Fahima Mohammed, one of the things that occurred was at the UNSC, well, for the first time, there was a Gaza ceasefire resolution. This was because the U.S. abstained. There were previous attempts where the U.S. vetoed. Some are saying that's a little too late. And it's just a political win where it emphasizes and kind of puts weight on what our guest there from Ramallah said, that these are just statements and words overall. I mean, we're looking at 32,000 Palestinians that have been killed. First of all, why do you think the U.S. went for that? And if you think it's too late for something like that in this stage, at this stage of the game, and if there is a ceasefire, then why aren't other countries moving to implement it and doing something about it?
I think in addition to what our guests have just mentioned, I think everyone can see now that in the context, there have been several international laws and principles that have been violated. And because also the journalists are still not allowed into Israel to actually comment and counter whatever has been done, so then it only is left for people to understand that what they've been seeing is the violence, which is continued attacks on the civilians, the infrastructure, the hospitals, which is the international human rights law. Then we've got the Geneva Conventions as well. The fourth Geneva Convention addresses the protection of civilians at the times of war. And as we can see, that it basically has got nothing that they are doing in attempt to actually save or give them any sort of way out of Rafah when there are statements directly from Netanyahu to actually enter. So these are another violation of these provisions, which is evident, and people are very concerned. We've also got the UN Charter, which prohibits the threat and use of force against territorial integrity or political independence of any state. So the aggression, again, is continuous. And then we've got the customary, which in the Palestinian context prohibits, genocide, and with the UN now stating that, of course, there are evidence for that. And again, the international criminal law stating the genocide being accountable under this international criminal law includes the deliberate targeting of civilians and systematic violence. So I guess these kind of adoption and principles are now being seen worldwide, and the pressure politically is definitely there, but nobody's implementing it because it's always been lip service. And the port that's being built is even made from the rubble. So they are trying different ways, and even UN spokesmen have said that they are, trucks miles away, basically there to give the aid, but just not being entered. So again, we can see that there is still support for the continuous bombardment and genocide that's happening, and nobody is actually taking any action, like you said. And the reasons being is because there's probably too much at stake for what is the end goal and their own propaganda and agenda for the actual land in Gaza.
Indeed. Well, we're looking now at what appears to be this rift, said number, which has different dimensions to it. I'm not too sure if we can call it a rift, because in words, it's one thing. In action, it's another. But one aspect of it is this U.S. abstention, where it is pretty significant in terms of the way that that has not only been done, but the way it has impacted this relationship between the U.S. and Israel. What do you think about that? Because we hear, of course, the delegation that was canceled by Israel to travel to the U.S., even though their military chiefs did meet. Netanyahu also said this cancellation is a message to Hamas in terms of the way we are dealing with the U.S. But nonetheless, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I think that the United States were sending a message also to Israel by this, situation in the Security Council. And particularly this message is to Netanyahu. It's quite clear that now there is a kind of a campaign in the United States to separate between Israel and the relationship between the United States and Israel, which is a solid kind of relationship, and they are committed to Israel, and they are going to continue supporting Israel. Today there was a meeting, to discuss the operation to Rafah, so the Americans are still participating in this war, and they are again going on with Israel on the strategic level. However, there are some problems between the administration and Netanyahu or the government of Israel. What the Americans are trying now to do by meeting Gallant alone and meeting Gantz alone, ministers in the government or the Israeli government, it means that they are trying, to push down Netanyahu, and they are saying quite clearly that it's Netanyahu is acting on his own interest rather than the interest of Israel. They are still committed to help Israel and to support Israel in all accounts, but at the same time, they want to send this message to Netanyahu, knowing by the end of the day that even this resolution being taken yesterday, it's not going to be implemented because Israel is not going to implement it. When did Israel implement any of the United Nations resolutions? We are talking about more than 1,000 resolutions in between the Security Council and the General Assembly, and Israel did not comply with even one single resolution. So the Americans do know that, and they know that they are going to support them if there were some pressure going on by other countries, like the today Colombian president said that we should start boycotting Israel if they did not comply with the resolution. This is a good gesture by the Colombian president, but at the same time, let's see other countries what they are going to do and how they are going to implement and force Israel to cease fire and so stop this aggression and this genocide against the Palestinians. I think that the Americans and Israeli do know that Israel is not going to comply.
Well, here's a problem. I don't know if you may see it this way or not, Fahima Mohammed, is the fact that you have the U.S. all-out support when this Operation Oslo Flood started. You have these four previous times that they came and they used their veto. But each time that they're doing that, you have hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that are being murdered, finally getting to the point where they abstain. And then you have, for example, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, saying civilian death toll is far too high and the amount of aid is way too low, far too low. Palestinians are dying as a result. And our guests there said the U.S. is continuing with its support. Palestinians are dying. People are losing their lives. If you take that out of the context of what's happening, that's what the end result is. There needs to be a way to speed things up. How do you see it?
I just think it's just showing and highlighting the U.S. hypocrisy in Gaza, the U.S. Secretary of Defense's acknowledgement of civilian casualties and insufficient humanitarian aid in Gaza highlights a discrepancy between the rhetoric and action, and the continued military support to Israel amid civilian casualties raises questions about the US policy coherence and commitment to human rights principles. And I think that at the end of the day, it's a political battle as well with regards to the upcoming elections, as well as in the US, as well as in the UK. And I think a lot of people are just trying to submit to some of the narratives that people are abiding by, the uproar of the protests, and obviously most people are now on the side of the Palestinians. So they just saying what they need to say, but in the end, the action is definitely not there. And again, there's no point delivering and surrounding all this aid. And at the same time, the aid is actually killing some of the civilians as well while they're distributing it off the air. And at the same time, facilitating and delivering to ensure that they are still providing the military aid. So it's very much a hypocrisy.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's take a look at these controversial airdrops, Sad Number, which is another controversy where you have 18 people who have drowned, several killed in stampedes from what we understand. Again, it goes back to the fact that you have the airdrops, which shows the U.S. intention that it actually cares, but yet you have supplies, arms, etc., that are being military supplied to the Israeli regime.
And I think that this is, you know, the biggest scam we ever heard of by the United States and Israel. Israel will allow Jordanian, Emiratis, and American airplanes to fly over Israel to send aid to Gaza, but the American can't pressurize the Israelis to open the gates and the crossings, especially not only Rafah, but we are talking about, you know, more than five crossings between Israel and Gaza, which they used to bring goods through it, more than 500 trucks every day. That was before the 7th of October. Now, America can't even open one or two of those crossings and allow more aid to get in, especially that the aid is piling up in on the other side of the Rafah crossings in Egypt. So it's already there, but the access is not there because of the Israeli regulations and the Israeli, you know, banning of the aid to come into Gaza. Now the Americans are sending these kind of airdrops, but at the same time they can't force the Israelis to open one of those crossings. It's unbelievable. I think it is a kind of a scam, or the Americans want to show around the world that we are trying our best and we are helping in, you know, getting food to the Palestinians who are starving and dying of starvation, especially north of Gaza. And we are doing our best in the humanitarian issue. And they are trying, you know, to show that they are these kind of good guys. At the same time, they are the one who are giving the Israeli the ammunition and giving them the rockets and giving them the all kind of supplies of to continue this war. And we know that they can stop the war, and we know that they can force Israel to open more crossings. So I think the whole thing is just, you know, a kind of a charade in front of the international community to say that we are doing our best. And in the future, they will say, we helped. We tried, right, and we gave them, you know, some food here and there by airdroppings.
Okay, this rift thing between the U.S. and Israel, however, in one respect, seems to be serious, Fahima, where we take a look at, for example, how there was a news source a week or more ago that said this military operation in Rafah, were Israel to go ahead with it, would lead to a shift in U.S. policy. We're looking at one shift that happened at the U.N., the other being the military assistance yearly of the U.S. to Israel. If we've seen the shift at the U.N., do you think the other is going to come?
I think the potential shift in U.S. policy is possibly a significant shift in U.S. policy in response to just Israel military operations in Rafah, reflects the growing international scrutiny of Israel's actions and their consequences, not necessarily what they actually would really do. So conditioning of military assistance could serve as a leverage point for influencing Israel's behavior. But again, to what extent do they have that power over Israel? Or are they still just, again, it's lip service, smoking screens? And again, just like our guest has mentioned, it's just, you know, saying and covering themselves to say we have tried our best so that they are not held accountable, but in the end, they have no control over Israel to make them do whatever they're doing. They're just only there as an ally to give whatever support and at the same time to cover themselves when it comes to any kind of future international kind of criminal investigation. And I think that's what they are actually doing. But obviously, there is so much that can be done that they're not doing. And it's not just the allies, it's also the surrounding countries as well. So there has to be accountability and responsibility, not just for the Western world, but also in the Middle East as well.
Yeah, talking about surrounding countries and this criminal proceedings that may actually involve other countries, there has been a somewhat of a contagion when it comes to stopping arms shipments to the Israeli regime. Canada has halted the arms sales to Israel. Sad number. We're looking at Denmark and Italy to have already suspended their arms exports. The Netherlands maybe has ruled the government to do the same. British Parliament, for example, some parliamentarians are calling on the government to put an end, even though the number of MPs is still not enough. What do you think about this trend? Do you think that this is something that's going to involve other countries as well?
Yeah, I think that the public in Europe and in other countries around the world who were going into demonstrations in support of Palestine and try to put an end to the Israeli aggression, started to get some results here and there. Well, if you remember, we talked about many times about, you know, the results of this war, and we said there are some changes occurring, and we said that changes on the international level, it will be slow a little bit, but sometimes it might be even much better. Now, I think few countries are starting, you know, to take some actions, and I believe this is a turning point, important point, for the future, to get out from the circle of America, because we know that the Europeans generally, and European Union as an organization in itself, they follow the Americans totally, and they agree with what the Americans are doing and the policies of America, whatever. So to see that few countries here and there is starting to act alone, and now we are hearing also that there are few countries in Europe who are willing to start and initiate recognition of Palestine as a full state. And that is also important. And they are breaking away from the mainstream policies of United States. Yeah, it is the pressure of the people. It's the pressure of the people which, you know, get these governments to start, you know, thinking differently. That might, you know, make the changes on a longer term, not on a short term. Short term, we can see only these few countries here and there who are willing, you know, to do something and to take action. But I was also amazed today with 120 parliamentarians in UK taking this decision, you know, or talking about, you know, stop sending weapons to Israel. Though, as you said, it's not enough, but at least this is a great move which we never anticipated before. Canada, which is an important ally to the United States, Italy, Spain. Okay. So we are talking about few countries, even in Europe or even in America, North America, they are trying, you know, to get somewhere, because the pressure is coming from their own public, and this pressure was a genuine one and really a big one, and it started to do some effect. We hope that other sure. countries also will follow in the same lines.
There are some questions about whether this is just, again, to impress the international community, because some of these export permits is said the approval prior to January 8th will still go through with them being delivered. Nonetheless, because of lack of time, we need to move to the successful campaign that the Yemenis have executed, Fahima Mohammed. If you can tell us about the way that this has actually surprised many, and it does remain a successful campaign, and unfortunate that Yemen is one of the only Arab countries to really stepped up to the plate and done what it has. What's your impression of the way that they've gone about this?
Yes, the Yemeni army's targeting of vessels bound for countries supporting the Saudi-led coalition reflects its efforts to disrupt the blockade and draw attention to the humanitarian crisis in Palestine as well as in Yemen. And the linkage between targeting vessels and ending the blockade highlights the Yemeni government's strategic objectives. And I think it has actually created a huge international uproar, and it has actually even made certain countries to actually back off a little bit, because it is going to affect trade and economics, you know, tremendously. So again, it was a huge wake up and a huge effort from Yemen. And I think that was quite brave, and for that to continue, in a way, did actually wake up the international community a little bit more than they expected to actually respond.
And to end the program, the ceasefire talks, I believe, is a good way to put into a question to you, Saad Nimr. What is going on there? At this point, it is maybe becoming a reality that the camp that says Netanyahu doesn't want a solution, because that would mean the end of his political career. Do you think that that's true?
Exactly. That's very much true. He knows that the moment that the ceasefire and stop the war. It means the defeat of Israel in its war against Gaza, providing that they said from the very beginning that they are going to eliminate Hamas and the Palestinian resistance and to release all the prisoners, and they failed in doing that. So it is a victory to the Palestinians, and it is the second victory after the 7th of October. This is on the one hand. So Netanyahu, he don't want to stop the war, and he don't want to go to any kind of deal with the negotiations, and he continued to put obstacles in front of this negotiations in order to make the war longer and longer, and he don't care about the prisoners, in spite of the fact of these demonstrations going on in Israel by the families of these prisoners. Still, Netanyahu, he prefer his own personal interest rather than the interest of Israel. All the parties in Israel are pressurizing also for these negotiations, including the not only the opposition, but also in his government. But yet, the other side of his government, the right wing, like Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, they are, you know, encouraging him to go on with the war and not to go for these negotiations. And Smotrich, he said it, I don't care about the prisoners, I care about occupying Gaza.
Thank you very much, Assad Nimr, Professor of Political Science, Brzezet University, from Occupied Ramallah. And Fahima Mohammed, thank you so much, broadcaster and TV presenter from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batawe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, thanking Allah in the holy month of Ramadan as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, dear listeners, it's an honor to be here. We are talking about how we should thank the Almighty Allah in this holy month of Ramadan as far as our Islamic lifestyle is concerned. So, it's interesting that one of the things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the exalted and the glorified, has requested all of us to do when it comes to the holy month of Ramadan is to thank Him. Now, this is something that many of us, unfortunately, we don't take into consideration. You know, we, again, because we're so busy in this nonstop rat race and this running around and this stress and anxiety and traffic and trying to make our ends meet, you know, we're so busy in all of these things that we rarely have time to think about those things which are truly important. And I would humbly say that a lot of the societies of the world, they are created so that people don't have enough time to think about their lives and to think about anything for that matter. So here, the Almighty Allah is telling people to thank Him. So, case in point is chapter number 2, Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 185 of the Holy Quran, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He speaks about the holy month of Ramadan, and He speaks about the Holy Quran. And towards the end of this verse in which Allah is talking about the holy month of Ramadan, He says that in this holy month, and really in general, you should exalt the greatness of Allah because Allah has guided you, and so that you may give thanks. So here again, this call from the Almighty Allah for us to thank Him in this holy month of Ramadan.
Ramadan al-mustabin jaa bin nur al-mubin. Ramadan, Ramadan, Ramadan al-qanitin.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how Allah,
the mighty, the exalted, the glorious, has requested us, and perhaps even you could say commanded us, to give thanks to him in this holy month of Ramadan, and of course as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. So as we have said in many of our previous programs, the things that we learn in the holy month of Ramadan should not be limited to the holy month of Ramadan. We need to take these things that we have learned and these beautiful realities that we have understood and these various different actions that we have done in this holy month and, you know, extrapolate them and take them in towards the rest of our life and do them in the rest of the year and really make them a part of our Islamic lifestyle. So giving thanks to Allah is one of those things. Another part of the Holy Quran, Allah says that give thanks so that I may increase your blessings and bounties. A very beautiful equation, if you will. The more that we thank the Almighty Allah, the more the Almighty Allah will give us. And of course, this thanking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not something that is to the benefit of God. It is to our own benefit, you know, because as a human being, as a spiritual being, as this entity that Allah has created, you know, one of the things that is honorable for us to do is to thank the one that has given us so many of our blessings, including guidance and, you know, Islam and faith and iman on one side, and to basic things such as being able to breathe, being able to see, being able to hear. So it is the honorable thing to do to give thanks to the Almighty Allah, and it is for our own benefit, something that we should definitely do in the holy month of Ramadan and also make a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. So alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/EN
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the World with Reporters.
To mark the National Day of Resilience and the 9th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, Yemenis have organized multiple events across the country. This year, they are also expressing their support for the people of Palestine as Israel carries out a genocide in the Gaza Strip. Several high-ranking officials participated in these events.
Today, we celebrate the steadfastness and standing up against an aggression that has continued for years. We are defending ourselves and resisting politically, economically, and militarily in the face of the barbaric aggression in which the whole world has allied with, and a siege that is still in place. Although 9 years have passed, the aggression is still ongoing and the siege has not stopped. Therefore, we will continue to stand together until the war stops completely.
Officials state that the Saudi-led war continues despite failing to achieve its stated objectives. They argue that the U.S. does not want the war to end, aiming to subdue the Yemenis, especially after Yemen began its naval operations in support of Palestine.
There are lots of agendas that were not achieved by the war in Yemen, and therefore America wants to at least reach the rest of its goals regarding Yemen. But the truth is that a Yemeni victory has been achieved, and we have imposed our presence. We united in political, military, and social level, so Yemen succeeded in absorbing the strategic transformations, imposing itself in the Red and Arabian Seas, and supporting the Palestinian cause. America has no choice but to accept this reality.
In the meantime, the spokesman for the Yemeni army reported 6 military operations over the past 3 days. These operations included targeting 3 American and British vessels with missiles and drones in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, while another vessel heading to Israeli-occupied ports was also hit. The Yemeni army also launched an attack on 2 U.S. destroyers. Yemeni forces also successfully struck the occupied territories with ballistic missiles.
After 9 years of U.S.-backed war and siege, observers believe that Yemen today is stronger than ever, being the only country to have supported Palestine through military action. They argue that Yemenis are confident they are on the right path as long as Washington continues to bombard and terrorize them. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For more than 170 days, the Israeli operations in the besieged Gaza Strip have resulted in the deaths of more than 32,000 individuals. The latest incident involves an attack on Al-Shifa Hospital, where witnesses have reported extensive atrocities. In reaction, Iranians assembled in front of the Turkish embassy on Monday to voice their indignation.
People gathered here to condemn Israeli genocide in Gaza, urging Muslim states, including Turkey, to halt exporting energy to the regime.
Participants lament that the international community has thus far remained silent regarding Israel.
We as women have come here with our children because we witnessed the Israeli action against Palestinian women and children. Sadly, the international community has remained silent.
Regrettably, Turkey as a Muslim nation exports significant raw materials, including metal, to Israel. If Turkey were to cut off this supply and prevent exports to Israel through the Ceyhan port, it would exert considerable pressure on Israel. We also call on other Muslim countries, like Azerbaijan, which supplies 40% of Israel's oil, to cease their support.
This plea follows Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, urging Muslim nations to cut political and economic ties with Israel. Protesters also cited Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, who highlighted the role of Muslims in opposing Israel by saying, "If the Muslims of the world united and each poured a bucket of water, Israel would be washed away." Farzan Ashuryun, Tehran.
In the Great Mosque of the Old City of Sana'a, the Yemeni Scholars Association convened a meeting calling for the nation's scholars to fulfill their role in the Al-Aqsa Fluid Battle and the ensuing victory. The event saw a significant turnout of Yemeni scholars.
Our message to the scholars who have shirked their responsibility to support Gaza is to fear God, for that will expose them to God's punishment in this world and the hereafter. Silence regarding what our brothers endure in Gaza amounts to participating in the Zionist enemy's crimes against children and women. The people will also justify their silence with the silence of their scholars and rulers. Therefore, their sin is greater than that of the rest of the people.
The participants criticized the inaction of Muslim scholars regarding the atrocities in Gaza, labeling it the genocidal war by Israel. They emphasized the scholars' profound responsibility, asserting their religious duty to support their Palestinian brothers. They argued that the current situation in Palestine is the consequence of decades of silence.
The responsibility of the scholars is great, as they are the ones who can move the streets and the people, and they can compel rulers to act with the fatwa or word from them in support of Gaza.
Since the onset of the war on Gaza, Yemeni scholars have actively participated in weekly demonstrations supporting Palestine and have encouraged public demonstrations in solidarity. Furthermore, the Scholars Association has declared its support for the Yemeni military's naval operations targeting Israeli maritime activities and its allies.
Yemeni scholars assert that the normalization deals between Arab countries and Israel have emboldened the regime to continue its oppressive campaign against Palestinians. They urge all Muslim scholars to advocate for Palestine, regardless of their government's possessions. Abdullah Al-Washali, Sana.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani will meet with U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington on April 15 for talks on the U.S. military presence in the Arab country. Also, a range of other issues, including the fight against Daesh and the ongoing Iraqi financial reforms, will be discussed.
The demands of Iraqi nation and political blocs will be taken to Washington by the Prime Minister. We all know there is a large consensus in the country to end the foreign forces' presence. The Prime Minister will also discuss the economic situation and challenges, most importantly, the U.S. dollar exchange rates, which have been affecting the market since the imposition of sanctions by U.S. Treasury on Iraqi banks.
In January, Baghdad and Washington began formal talks about ending the coalition mission, purportedly formed to help the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. After the defeat of Daesh in 2017 by Iraqi anti-terror forces, the U.S. still stationed some 2,500 troops in Iraq and 900 in neighboring Syria as a part of the coalition mission.
It's time for the government to end the coalition mission. It's the demand of the Iraqi people. We all agree that these forces have gone too far, violating our sovereignty, so today we witness the calls by the Iraqi nation that the time has come for these forces to leave.
Following the parliamentary decision in 2020, Iraqi authorities have agreed for drawing up a timeline to end the presence of foreign forces, which proved by action to be a threat to the country's stability. Iraqi nation agrees that foreign forces' presence is no longer necessary, and the Prime Minister will carry their demands to Washington. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Salman Qasimi, an Islamic school teacher, says it's an unprecedented move in India to ban madrasas instantly, calling it a blow to marginalized Muslim families across India's most populous state of Uttar Pradesh. He says lives of thousands of families are directly dependent on such institutions, while the government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi accuses them of receiving illegal funding. Scholars argue such institutions are building blocks of Islamic teachings across the country, which regular schools can't do.
This judgment is unfortunate. We respect the court decision, but we oppose it. Our constitution allows us to have such schools to teach Islamic values to future generations. If this is against secularism, why it was made in the first place? Every citizen can read, write, promote or propagate their religion. That's what our constitution says. Madrasa's instant closure is a blow to livelihood of thousands of families.
In January, the government of Uttar Pradesh state halted a funding program for madrasas, leaving more than 20,000 teachers unemployed. Scholars say Friday's verdict applies to all Islamic schools in the state that are privately and government funded. In recent months, India's northeastern state of Assam converted hundreds of madrasas into conventional schools.
All the laws and all the things which are BJP is enacting or BJP is targeting the Muslim community, definitely they think that if they want to rule the country, so they can rule the country when they can demonize Muslim community, they can suppress Muslim community, they can make them wetless at the time of election. So all these efforts are taking place because of the RSS background, RSS agenda of the present ruling party.
In recent months, Modi's government turned down new proposals from the states and halted payments to schemes that would finance Muslim schools. Critics say this amounts to snatching the livelihood of thousands of families instantly, while they have no other means of earning.
India will hold general elections in a few weeks' time, and the BJP's victory is imminent, according to observers. Activists and rights groups have accused the governing party of promoting anti-Islamic rhetoric in a deliberate attempt to appease the majority voters by polarizing the voters, therefore using divide and rule policy to win the elections.
Rights groups have accused the BJP government of persecuting and intimidating Muslims through all possible means. The accusation BJP rejects, saying India is a vibrant democracy enshrined in equality for all. Critics accuse the ruling party of systematic repression against the largest minority group, including hate crimes, mob lynching and cow vigilantism amid rising Islamophobia. Observers say such issues pave the way for Prime Minister Modi to remain in office for a third consecutive term. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Pakistan has joined the global celebrations of a very special Nowruz that has coincided with the month of Ramadan. Nowruz, which translates to New Day, is celebrated by millions of peoples worldwide as the Persian New Year, symbolizing rebirth, renewal, and arrival of spring.
To all my fellow Pakistanis celebrating Nowruz, I say let's cherish our cultural diversity and come together in solidarity. May this new year bring us prosperity, peace, and happiness.
Despite its Persian origins, Nowruz in Pakistan is celebrated with a distinctive local flavor, incorporating regional traditions and customs. Pakistanis have their own customs to welcome Nowruz. Besides preparing special meals and decorating the dining area with special dried and fresh fruits, the ancient occasion also creates an opportunity for individuals to mend broken ties, forgive others, let go of the past, and build stronger relationships in the coming new year.
For me, Nowruz is a time of reflection and renewal. It's a reminder to leave behind the past year's troubles and embrace the opportunities that lie ahead. It's a celebration of life, growth, and the beauty of nature.
We clean our house, we visit our friends, we celebrate this day, we enjoy a lot of festive foods, and you know, this day brings a lot of joy and happiness in our lives. So, happy Nowruz to all of you.
Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif have extended their heartfelt greetings to all those who are celebrating Nowruz in Pakistan and around the world. Both leaders also called for embracing the spirit of Nowruz and promoting the message of peace, compassion, unity, and kindness.
Nowruz signifies regeneration at the start of a new cycle. It transcends simple festivity, standing as a cultural landmark that enhances the diversity of human society. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
After weeks of silence, Kitab Hezbollah Resistance Group, one of the biggest units within Iraq's popular mobilization units, reminds the government, as well as officials in the committee tasked with overseeing the withdrawal of U.S. military, that they should not grant immunity to the occupying forces, or else gates of hell will open.
These foreign forces have been violating our sovereignty for years now. In January 2020, Donald Trump ordered the assassination of our anti-terror commanders, Lieutenant General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad airport. And lately, they are violating it by assassination of Iraqi resistance commanders.
Kitab Hezbollah also warned that any removal of leaders of popular mobilization units must be decided by the PMU internally. It says acting otherwise would be a significant mistake.
Our government has made it clear on multiple occasions that the need for U.S. military forces have ended. Our security forces are capable of running the country's security system and face any threat. Washington is clearly trying to rally around the negotiations, and it is a clear attempt to delay their withdrawal from the country.
In January, the Iraqi resistance decided to halt the attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. The attacks were started on October 19 in solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Observers say that the suspension was to allow a climate of serenity for talks between Baghdad and Washington over the U.S. military presence. But as some have rightly noted, Washington has no intention to change its behavior in Iraq.
It is obvious that Washington is trying to gain more time to keep its military presence in Iraq. Our government needs to push forward and speed up the pace of negotiations to end the presence of these foreign forces and save our country's political, economic, and social stability.
On paper, advisory purposes, as well as training the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. However, in practice, the U.S. forces have shown a different objective by violating Iraqi sovereignty, attacking PMU positions, and killing top Iraqi commanders. Since the start of their operations in October, the resistance in Iraq has been pushing the government to end the U.S. military presence in the country. Also, they have time and again reiterated their solidarity with Palestinians. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
Russian President Vladimir Putin addressed the nation after the deadly attack in Moscow, which killed dozens of civilians. The president denounced the massacre as a bloody and barbaric terrorist attack, as he declared March 24, a National Day of Mourning. At least 11 suspects, including four perpetrators who directly participated in the shooting spree, have been arrested. The four direct perpetrators were detained in Bryansk region. According to the intelligence service, the terrorists planned to cross the Russian-Ukrainian border. The Russian president vowed to punish all involved in the massacre.
All the perpetrators, organizers, and customers of this crime will suffer a fair and inevitable punishment, whoever they are, whoever guides them. I repeat, we will identify and punish everyone who stands behind the terrorists, who prepared this atrocity. This attack on Russia, on our people.
The Daesh Takfiri terror group claimed responsibility, but Moscow has dismissed the claim, asserting that investigation is still underway to ascertain the main culprits. Russia's security service says the Moscow attackers had contacts in Ukraine supporting them. During interrogation, a detained terrorist said he was promised 5,000 rubles to carry out the terrorist attack. He claimed he watched a certain preacher on Telegram, and allegedly his assistant contacted the man.
The perpetrators are ignorant, illiterate people who will commit any crime for money. The question is different. Where is the planning center? Not a single international organization can act in the international arena, especially in a state like Russia, where there are strong power structures. Performers can be found anywhere through the agents. We went through this experience in Chechnya. This once again convinces us that international terrorist structures are the work of the CIA and Western intelligence services.
The attack, which came amid Ukraine's war with Russia, was the deadliest in the country since the Beslan school siege in 2004. After Friday's attack, Putin held discussion with his Belarusian counterpart Alexander Lukashenko. Both leaders confirmed their readiness to work together in the fight against terrorism.
In his address, President Putin said Moscow attackers were preparing to flee towards Ukraine, where a window had been prepared for them with the help of Ukraine. Now it remains to be seen how Russia is going to react to the massacre, which came in a very volatile region and amid its war against Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Syrians used to say, no one sleeps hungry, but that was 13 years before the devastating terrorist war that was waged upon them, the war that has pushed many Syrians below the poverty line. SAID is an association that has been helping these people by providing daily meals to the needy during the fasting month for over a decade. Despite the increasing challenges, they are determined to continue with their mission.
We're currently operating a kitchen called Hunger Be Gone. Unfortunately, our resources this year are less than previous years due to the circumstances the country has been through, such as the earthquake disaster that drained a lot of financial resources. We distribute around 200 to 250 meals every day to the people who come to the association, while our motorcycle team also delivers meals to remote areas.
As a chef, I start every day at 9 a.m. by preparing the water and cooking the chicken for the scheduled meal.
I have been volunteering for 5 years to help my fellow countrymen in these difficult circumstances.
Syrians have demonstrated their sense of responsibility in various ways during this crisis, particularly during the month of Ramadan. The Holy Month of Mercy encourages people to be selfless and to help alleviate the sufferings of others. Voluntary work is one of the ways through which Syrians showcase their contributions to society.
So we are here not only to donate financially, but to donate our time more specifically. Volunteering is something very important, especially for our generation. We need to teach people that giving doesn't always mean that you need to take something in return. So we're here to volunteer with our time, to try to help people as much as we can. So Sa'ad Association is our vessel to do that.
Today we came to make meals for the people in need. First we cut the vegetables, then we shredded the chicken, and now we are cooling down the rice and the chicken. Then we're gonna put it in boxes and give it to people in need.
Despite the United States' theft of their resources and the inhuman sanctions imposed upon them, which have put Syrians in dire living conditions, they steadfastly hold on to their love for their country. United against all the odds, they strive to find their way through this dark tunnel towards the dawn of a brighter life.
Syrians have always firmly stood together, not only against terrorism, but also in the face of unjust Western sanctions, through voluntary initiatives that show their love to each other and to their homeland. Ibrahim Wahid, Damascus.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is me, Asma. Once more, I have the pleasure to be at your service. And then here with me, I have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Mustafa, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum assalam.
So, as the ritual of this program goes, I would love you both to introduce yourself pretty briefly. Let's start with Sister Nahid.
Assalamu alaikum to you and your dear listeners. My name is Nahid, and I'm so honored to be with you and your listeners today.
Thank you very much for being here, and your brother Mustafa.
My name is Mustafa, and I'm studying here in the Hauza. I'm studying psychology here, and I'm originally from Pakistan, but I've lived in different countries.
So thank you very much, both of you, for coming here and for joining us in today's episode. Well, as we can see in our everyday life, there are different attitudes toward being active in a society. Like, some people do everything alone and still they presume themselves to be active people or socially engaged people. There are also another people who work in a community and they pretty much naturally believe that they are being so active. So now, which one is going to be the truest one? Is there any way to put it this way, that, okay, the one who's working alone is going to be more successful, or the one who's going with the community is going to be more successful?
I guess there is no true false between these two groups of people.
I think there is, anyway.
And it depends on the personality traits of people. Clearly, extrovert people would like to work in groups within the other people, and introverted people would prefer like working alone. And I don't think like there will be one best group, if you want to call them, or even divide them into two parts. But I personally...
So you mean that those people who go alone in their path might be successful, and those people who are doing in community also might be going through a failure.
Even like if you form a business point of view, you'll see that they're able to do a lot more because you have so many brains working together. They're able to solve more problems. Yeah. When you're alone, you may be able to think only one dimensionally, where someone else from the outside can give you another point of view, right? So that's what kind of helps you to improve and get better when you have other people with you.
Thank you. great scientists in the history of human being. They have always worked alone.
Yeah. And they were more focused, you know?
Yeah, they were more focused. There's one direction that they are going through. They know what they're going to do.
And there are less challenges on their
way. Especially nowadays, I would say, like, if you look at universities that work on